ready to go.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's February 27th, 2017. We've got a few bills up today. We'll start out with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 283. So we'll do that. Patrick?
I think, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 283 appropriates $4,179,000 from the general fund of the Department of Administrative Services for the Reedsport Levy Project. This measure has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. It also comes to us with a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, with the appropriation, of course. And with the measure, we also have received the fiscal impact statement and also a statement of no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Kati McHugh, and I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast. My district goes from the southern edge of Coos Bay to the northern edge of Yahats, and I have the great good pleasure of representing the fine city of Reedsport. And this Senate bill comes to you today at the request of myself and Senator Roblin and Representatives Boone and Gomberg. Because aging coastal levees are a problem in many of our districts. But I think it's fair to say that in Reedsport, they are the poster child for why this is a very, very serious problem. Three-quarters of the businesses in Reedsport exist in what they call the downtown area, and the levees were a response to the 64 flood. They were completed in 1969. Under, of course, different engineering standards. And what's happening is because of changes at FEMA, they are at risk of all of their rates skyrocketing. There's a Corps of Engineers nexus here with what's happening with the standards that levees have to meet now. And so these levees are going to have to be improved to meet federal requirements under modern standards. So as you can see, this has the potential to be devastating to the city of Reedsport. What I'd like to do is turn this over to Jonathan Wright, who is the manager of the city of Reedsport. He has people with him who would like to testify on why this investment is incredibly important to the success and the survival of the economy in Reedsport. And on that note, sir, I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Wright.
Okay, I'm going to recess just for a minute to allow Senator Winters to testify on the bill. She has to get back to committee.
Certainly.
I appreciate that. So we will recess just for a moment on Senate Bill 208, and we will open a public hearing on We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 316. Patrick and Senator, if you want to testify, please.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 316 directs the Oregon Wine Board to establish and operate a program for wine market access and wine promotion. It specifies that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is to pay $1.5 million in wine production and distribution tax revenues to the Board of County each year to allow the Board to carry out the program. A measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have a Dash 1 amendment. With the Dash 1 amendment, we've received a statement of further analysis required from the legislative revenue and a fiscal impact statement for the bill, Mr. Chair. And that fiscal impact statement will be distributed in just a moment.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Chair Byers and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Jackie Winters. I represent District 10, which is here in a portion of Salem, Monmouth, Independence, and Almondville, and Turner. Senate Bill 316 is a bipartisan bill with support from members of both chambers, which is nice when I can get both. I've always been, as most of you know, immensely proud of our Oregon wine industry. With some key wineries and vineyards that are located in my district, and I'm sure probably some of your districts as well. I heard about the challenges that face Oregon wineries in trying to get their premium wines to customers in Oregon and throughout the United States and around the world. Even though our wineries are making a quality product, it is disheartening to know our Oregon wines only have 1.5%, and I say 1.5% market share for our U.S. wines sold in U.S. retail markets versus 90% for California wines. Even here in Oregon, more California, Washington, and important wines and import rights is sold versus Oregon. You know, colleagues, We need to put resources behind creative new programs that help open up new markets for our Oregon wines. Part of the MRIS funding also goes to critical industry research that keeps the focus on making quality wines. We are growing wine industry, but if we want to thrive, we as policymakers must assist the industry with tools that will allow it to compete nationally and globally. Colleagues, I hope this committee will continue to support Oregon industry by passing Senate Bill 316 to Ways and Means Committee. And colleagues, I can remember in the days when there were those who were skeptical that we would even could grow grapes and wine and produce wines here in Oregon. And I think that has been proven wrong. It is also, if you look, colleagues, you will notice that we become a really growing industry, and I just want to grow it and be able to actually to be a part of the rest of the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Winters? Seeing none, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, we will now recess on Senate Bill 283 and, excuse me, wrong one, recess on Senate Bill 316 and reopen a hearing on Senate Bill 283. And gentlemen.
Thank you, Chairman Byers.
This is Reed's book.
Good evening. Good afternoon. PowerPoint very often.
I grab my glasses.
Thank you very much. All right, we're back.
Okay, now we're there.
Well, they already gave up the ghost here. I came up with this nice title here.
Could I have you put your name on the record, please?
What's that?
Put your name on the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jonathan Wright, City Manager, City of Reedsport.
Thank you.
I wish we were here talking about wine, because that was a much more exciting topic. So came up with this really exciting title to kind of grab you all in, but Representative McEwen already gave up the ghost, and we're here to talk about a levee system. So where are we located? We're located in coastal Douglas County at the intersection of Highway 38 and 101 between Florence and Coos Bay. So why are we here? Well, we're here to protect the public assets and protect the public in general, and also because those people on the other side there told us we had to do a lot of stuff with our levee system. As we become well aware with the conditions that have been happening down in California as well as Louisiana a few years back, levees are a critical piece of infrastructure for any community that has one. Accordingly, Code of Federal Regulations 44, Section 6510 regulate the design requirements for these and require them to be reevaluated ever so often. The current project area, as Representative McEwen stated, contains about three-quarters of our businesses. It also contains all of our local governmental offices, including federal, state, and local, all of our state resources, local resources, yards, equipment, so forth, even the local library. It's home to about 400 low-income households. Those are apartments and HUD-subsidized units. It's also home to 250 low-income single-family dwellings, which by low-income, a household value of $100,000 or less, or housing value of $100,000 or less. It also contains all of our fuel and food source distribution areas. It contains almost three-quarters of a mile of Highway 101, three-quarters of a mile of Highway 38, and almost three-quarters of a mile of railroad. According to people that have a higher degree than I do, there's a very high level of social vulnerability in this area, and this is due to extremely high level of unemployment and high poverty level. That's from the Census Bureau. The median household income in Reedsport is just over $32,000 annually. So looking at the impacts, What do we expect? This is actually a picture from California 2 weeks ago. According to our analyst who did the beast cost benefit analysis on this, we can expect a highway closure of around 3 months, around $8 million in personal property damage, around 1,100 low to moderate income households would be displaced, and of course those food and fuel distribution areas will be destroyed. So what have we done? We've done actually a lot. We're part of a coalition that works with other levee owners, and as we try to creep through this process together, and I think we're about 60% in front of just about everybody else that's a levee owner. So we've done the preliminary engineering assessment, the hydrology, hydraulics, the bathymetry, the geotechnical analysis, and a preliminary interior drainage analysis, which we still have the final one to do, which will happen this next fiscal year. So far, we've partnered with our Urban Renewal District. We luckily got a grant from FEMA for $225,000. And thank you to the legislature 2 years ago for the allowing IFA to start granting grants for levees and then city funds. So what the analysis has come out with is that we, and I have the engineer, John Wells from Anderson Perry, the city's contracting engineer, to discuss it a little bit further after I'm done. But we do have to increase the levee, earthen levee sections, replace and upgrade infrastructures, and especially around the highways, which he'll go into a little bit. The highways that come through this area have caused a significant amount of settlement, and those are our most vulnerable areas. And then we have some sheet pile to work on, and that's an estimated cost of $4,179,000. Just to give you a financial picture, hey, Senator Roman, a financial picture of why we're here. You guys are doing a lot of work on the tax structure. Well, we are the only city in Douglas County that's in full tax compression. 80% of our properties are under the taxable ceiling and have met the taxable ceiling, and our tax revenues have gone down by $250,000 in the last 5 years. So what we can levy from a stormwater fund and most recently a street fund we added a fee on to is our current annual debt service of $50,000 total. So if you look at what that would amortize out to based on a 20-year loan at 5%, we have debt service capacity of about $625,000 currently. And as stated previously, we need quite a bit more than that. So what do you get in return? Well, we avoid the damage to the state highways in that area. We retain the existing labor force by protecting the economic hub of Western Douglas County. And we also avoid the NFIP flood insurance standards for the area, which doesn't go to the state. It goes to the federal government through FEMA insurance costs, and that would be $1.5 million approximately. So the project outcomes, we increase the area resilience to natural disasters, including sea level rise. We protect the social vulnerability of populations, or socially vulnerable populations, both physically and economically. Like I said before, our annual household income there is $32,000, and if you look at what the average household cost in this area is, it's $100,000, which means that the houses in this area are just affordable. Anything beyond that, if you add about $4,000 in FEMA flood insurance premiums, those houses no longer are affordable for those residents. We're going to fortify and protect state transportation assets. We're going to protect cultural elements of the city, which include the city's historic downtown area, promote reinvestment in the area by instilling consumer confidence in that we've invested in our system, and have engineering analysis to demonstrate that it can withstand the elements that it's supposed to, which would also protect the local employment centers, and protect the economic impact from the National Flood Insurance Program. And for anybody who's been through Reedsport, if you've ever seen where the Safeway lies, it's one of the lowest areas. And so if you think about the FEMA Flood Insurance Program, if they were to do a remodel of that structure, they'd be forced to elevate it 6 to 8 feet in the air, which, of course, with the ADA ramps and other requirements would never happen. But that kind of paints the picture where a community that was built behind a levee system never in regards to the National Flood Insurance Program, which means that most of those houses, their base flood elevation, or their finished floor is well below the base flood elevation, costing them the highest premiums out there. So this would also protect the city's funds that we could then reinvest in maintaining the state's investment. So I will turn it over to Anderson Perry, the city's engineer, or actually I'm going to turn it over to Senator
Roblin. We'll let Senator Roblin speak. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. I have a committee that I'm in the other day, and two more bills over there. So I will go quickly and just say, for the record, Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5. Reedsport is close to home and me at Coos Bay. I had the opportunity to come down to the city and have a presentation done of all of this stuff and actually then go and look at some of the areas. The thing that was interesting to me is to recognize that, you know, we didn't really think we had a problem because the Corps of Engineers took care of these for a long time. And then they basically gave them back to us. And they gave them back to us in a lot different condition than when they were first put in. So if you, as you go through this history of this, you're going to see there are most of the dikes have sunk. All of this land is land that when you put a lot of stuff on it, over time it sinks down a little farther. So our dikes are not as high as they need to be almost anywhere in the dike system. Secondarily, they put in sheet piling in one section in particular to put a line in the sand basically and say water on this side, here's the sheet pile. But they didn't put the sheet pile down deep enough. So right now, I'm surprised they're still standing, because, and they'll go through that conversation too. The stuff that's in the ground is not as tall as the stuff that's out of the ground, so it's easy for it to just flip. And once it does that, 101 goes under, because even in now, you don't have to have a big flood to get down there. The bridge that goes across and attaches the dike system on 101, there's a bridge. It has also sunk, and you can start to see how the members are kind of coming apart because of the sinkage on one end of that particular deal. If you've ever been in Reedsport, they have an interesting system where if the flood starts to happen, they have boards to put in place to keep the water out of the center portion. And they have to maintain and manage that. Another part of the area where, because it's a massive deal, they put concrete deals, they're sinking as well. There's a lot of work to do. I know they've done the geotextual. You're going to hear that. They've drilled on this levee all the way around to find out what's down there and what do they have to do and what kind of stuff they have to do to replace it. I'm actually surprised that it's only a little over $4 million. The truth of the matter is this is just one case. The coast is going to have a lot of these. We need to really have a conversation not only here but with the federal government about the responsibilities for helping us build these places and then turning them back over to us. Reedsport without the levee system does not exist as we know it. There's lots of places that could survive. The rail line goes through there. I think it's probably just barely above the flood level because it's been raised in different places. And it is one side of the levee system as part of the rail line and the levee that was put there. So all of those things are important for the whole South Coast. But Reedsport in particular, and I've been impressed with their ability to go out and find resources and do other kinds of things. It just came to the point where we had no other option, and so I was happy to drop this bill for the city and try to figure out what we can do here as we move forward. It is part of our transportation structure. It's not only 101, which will be, I think, take the brunt, but on the other side is 38, which is the other connecting road. So those two are the state roads that will be impacted clearly if we have a flood. So I want to thank these people for being here, our city manager, and you're going to hear the report that I got to see a while back about all the technical information we've already and paid for. Now it's, I hope, our time to help at the state. So thank you. Yes,
thank
question?
You, Senator.
Senator Roblin, there's two ways to go about getting this money. The other route is to make a request to LFO directly to go to Capital Construction.
It's true.
Instead of a bill, I would strongly encourage you to do that.
Have that conversation.
And then I notice you're asking for general funds. I don't know what the payback is. You might want to go lottery. I don't know. Something you need to discuss with them. But I would for sure do the LFO the LFO direct request. Lori can help you through that if you need.
Okay. And I'll talk to the chair of that subcommittee. That would be good, too.
Senator, my thought would be if it goes down there, it's going to end up in your Capital Construction.
Anyway.
It does, but it's really important to make the list, and the bills sometimes are
separate.
Don't
make it on the list.
And so in LFO really will have a lot of questions that need to be answered that we're not going to ask here. So
okay.
I think it's important to do both routes since you started it already, but
I appreciate that very much. He happens to be the chair of that subcommittee, so it's a good thing for him to ask.
Thank you, Senator. We'll let you go back to your committee.
Okay, I'll go test.
Wait a minute. Hold on.
Oh, yes.
That nice little museum that's in the middle of Reedsport.
It will be underwater.
That was the question.
It's right next to the levee. It's right on the waterfront there.
And the second question is, the water threat is primarily from the Umpqua flooding?
Yes.
Not from the ocean?
Not from the ocean. Well, ocean rise is happening, so we anticipate that there will be a combination of those. Because from where the river goes all the way, it still has a few miles to get to the ocean, but it's all tidal influenced, so actually all the way up to Scottsburg. So there is a tidal influence, and there will be a tidal influence as sea level rises. The common level of where it's going to be will be a little higher.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Gotta love the coast.
Gotta love the coast.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. I'm John Wells. I'm an engineer with Anderson Perry. I live in Umatilla County. And
if you could run us, we don't need a whole lot of the details. You want to run us through?
I won't burden you with too many details, other than just to let you know the basics of where they've come to. And I think it's been really well covered by those who've spoke previously about what's happening there with the levees. They are settling. They have settled over time, and we do have the geotech results coming together. The borings have been done. The field work's been done. The hydraulics have been done, and some preliminary plans have been developed. And so, in some of the handouts that we've given you, it shows you some of those specific characteristics of this. It's been very effectively said that, if this is not done and we get a major flood, we could have, up to 6 feet of water in there on the roadways, which would make 101 impassable, as well as 38 coming in from the east. So that would be a challenge for this area, and being able to work through a flood and a major flood would be a challenge for them. Also, just know that the work that's been done so far has also included some work on some additional lift stations and looking at how to accommodate the city to be able to look at pumping that water effectively and to be able to handle that 100-year flood and to provide resiliency. And so that has also been done. And there's a request in to FEMA to get some funding for that as well. And so that's in the works. So the city's been aggressive in trying to get the funding from folks to make those pieces happen as well. We expect going forward that the flood study will eventually make its way through FEMA and will become accepted, and that it will actually change the flooded areas, and it will actually impact the taxpayers at that point. And so it's important that, while they have this grace period, that they be actively working on these various systems to be able to get them more resilient and to meet what they call the CFR 6510 requirements for FEMA for levees. And so that's a large part of it. The interaction of the bridges. The Schofield Bridge is also one of the challenges. The Umpqua and the Schofield come together right at this point, and then as Senator Monroe pointed out also, the coastal does have a backwater effect, and so if all of those things hit at the same time, you do have substantial flooding, and it can back up into this area, and it's not just a little bit of water, so it's a lot of water. I think just to close, I'd just like to say thank you for your time and the opportunity to share this with you. And I think that these proposed improvements will go a long ways towards solving some of these issues. We've had conversations ongoing with ODOT discussing the bridges and discussing alternatives of what could be done in particular. The Schofield Bridge is a little bit bigger challenge than the Umpqua Bridge. On the Umpqua side of things, sandbags could be used to effectively shut off a high flood event on that side of town, but on the Schofield side of town, that's not the case. If it came to a major flood, the sandbags would have to go all the way across the roadway, and that doesn't work very well for traffic. So that's the challenge that we've kind of tried to figure out ways to get around and tried to make it so that it's the least expense to get a temporary solution, which would also take care of that, and that's also discussed in this little summary packet. So, with that,
is this based on the projections based on a 100-year flood?
It is. Yes, that's correct.
And you have a number of openings, or do you have closures? How do you close them?
So the city has a fire department, and they practice
volunteers, great people.
They practice annually closing those
sandbags.
No.
No, they're actually I-beams, and they set slat wooden slats and then cover it with visqueen.
It's 4 foot or 4 inch wide thick beams that slide down into those slots that close off the actual structures.
Not the most high tech, but it's very effective.
And it takes how long to erect it? About a day to close all of them?
It takes about 4 firefighters and 20 minutes apiece.
For each closure, and there's 7 of them. So they have to put them together, and they practice that annually as to how to assemble those to make those closures.
We are really in tune with our river gauge.
Questions, Senator?
Yeah, and I apologize if I was late getting here, but the $4 million that you're asking for, are you capable of a match anywhere? I know you have some FEMA money. The city put out some money. The reason I ask is free money usually goes through lottery, and it's a lot harder to come by because you can imagine everybody wants free money, but if you have money that can act as a match, that's a lot easier to get.
Senator, I had that one slide on there that showed our current debt service capacity, which is very limited. What we would hope for is that if this committee saw fit, would be to take whatever portion that you are providing and then match it possibly with FEMA dollars or other dollars that we can come up with. I don't have a clear picture at this time, Senator.
Okay, that's fine.
Other questions? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, when's the last time you had to put the barriers up? Was it 96 or?
2005. Before that was 96.
Yeah, I remember 96.
So much for a 100-year flood.
No,
100-year flood every 10 years. Okay, thank you.
Others? Thank you, gentlemen. I have nobody else who wishes to testify on this. Is there anybody else? Seeing none, we will
send it down to
close the public hearing. Should we move it into work session?
Yeah, you're moving
we'll
it to
open a work session on the bill and remove it. Yeah. We're moving it to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 283 to the floor with a due pass and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator has moved the bill to the floor with a due pass and with the subsequent to Ways and Means, where just for the record, I assume that will get referred to the capital construction and be dealt with down there.
Yeah, I still like
that. And you can work with Senator Roblum on the general request. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none. I lost my agenda here somewhere. Senate Bill, still yours. Senate Bill 283 is moved to Senate floor with the due pass with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And we'll let Senator Roblin carry that. Oh, he doesn't have to because it's going to Ways and Means. That's right. So we'll close on that. We will reopen on Senate Bill 316. And we got a bunch of people here. Okay. And let's see here. Mr. Jarman and Mr. Bruneau and Mr. Thompson. Welcome, gentlemen.
For the record, my name is Steve Thompson.
You don't want to deal with him?
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 316, the Oregon Wine Marketing Access and Research Investment Strategy, MARIS, a priority for the Oregon Wine Growers Association this session. I'm the CEO of Christom Vineyards and a partner with Octa Vineyard in Walla Walla. I have 35 years of experience as a restaurant and hotel industry executive and an executive with both small and large U.S. wholesalers and large and small Oregon wineries. I also serve as president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association and chair of the Oregon Wine Board, and I chair our industry's marketing and export committees. The reason behind this bill is simple. Our Oregon industry is at a critical juncture which requires dedicated focus on developing new and expanded markets for our Oregon wines and to target some specific wine industry scientific research. The Oregon wine industry has seen unparalleled growth over the past 10 years. 702 wineries and 1,000 grape growers, a 500% increase over the past 15 years. Around 70% of these wineries produce fewer than 5,000 cases per year, which means they are small businesses, usually family-owned, primarily operating in rural Oregon. Oregon consistently outperforms U.S. and international competitors by producing superior wines sought out by consumers throughout the world. At the same time our producers are making award-winning wines with increased production, we are seeing fewer pathways to getting our products to market, in part because of the declining number of distributors across the United States. In 1995, there were 2,600 wineries and 3,000 distributors. In 2015, there were 8,800 U.S. wineries and 700 distributors. As a participant in all three tiers of our industry's mandated three-tier go-to-market system over the last 35 years, I can attest to the great progress that our industry has made, even as wineries from California, many of them larger corporate entities who have enjoyed great marketing advantages based on scale of size and scale of yield compared to Oregon's wine industry. Though most of the world's great wine regions have been in existence for many centuries, our small Oregon industry has made its way onto the world stage in just 50 years. Our industry is such an important strategic asset for our state, and we must carefully nurture it. To go to the next level, our industry needs the help that a continued and expanded capacity to market our wines better globally will deliver for us. The numbers speak for themselves. According to Nielsen, of all U.S. wines sold at retail in the United States, Oregon wines only have 1.5% of the market share. This compares to 90% for California wines and 6% for Washington wines. In fact, California Pinot Noirs outsold Pinots in Oregon last year by a ratio of 8-1 nationally. Even here in Oregon, you might be surprised to know that Oregon wine sales rank fourth behind California at a 55% share, Washington at 17% share, and overseas imports at 15%. Oregon's share of our local retail market is just 14%. Looking at Nielsen data nationally, we struggle to get to market, but where we do get to market, we really perform well. Oregon wines are on just 32% of store shelves nationally versus 97% for California and 82% for Washington. On store shelves across the entire country, there are an average of 5 Oregon wines per store against 151 California wines and 13 Washington wines per store. More importantly, looking at calendar year-over-year national sales 2015 to 2016, Oregon wine is up 15.1% in dollar sales across the country versus 5.2% for California and 13.3% in volume sales versus 2.6% for California. While many more Oregon wineries are finding distribution out across the country, they often do not have the financial means or the marketing expertise to grow and build their brands. California and Washington invest much more heavily in market access. Of course, we are not just marketing wine when we do this. We are also marketing Oregon tourism. We also need investment marketing development efforts via industry education and training, like we saw at last week's enormously successful Oregon Wine Symposium. By the way, the second largest industry symposium in the Western Hemisphere. While we are far behind in sales, we are winning on quality. Over the past 2 years, Oregon, with only 1.5% domestic market share, accounts for 20% of all U.S.-made wines rated 90 plus points on Wine Spectator's 100-point scale. The critical marketing need is to enhance and extend the reach, frequency, and impact of the industry's distribution and promotional programs. These efforts must target prospective wine consumers in target markets, encouraging tourism, spending in Oregon, and ongoing purchase of Oregon wine when our guests return home. Many of our wineries would benefit from and be much more economically viable and sustainable for the long run by building a healthier market ecosystem nationally and globally. Senate Bill 316 would allocate $1.5 million currently going to the general fund from wine taxes for a specialized program that seeks to create new worldwide market access opportunities for Oregon wineries and enhance research that will benefit the entire industry. These funds would be directed to the Oregon Wine Board to implement Maris. The infusion will fund initiatives focused on increased global market penetration and expanding consumer access to Oregon wines, stimulating profitable Oregon food and wine tourism, leveraging productive alliance relationships with Travel Oregon and the state's regional destination marketing organizations, while also forging new partnerships. Scientific research to ensure continued advances in grape and wine quality while addressing serious viral and climate change threats across the state. The broad program areas would be focused on developing new market expansion opportunities, especially for smaller wineries, increasing awareness and targeting domestic and overseas customers, leveraging greater research investments, and enhancing existing local promotional events. The Oregon Wine Board would ensure that these new Maris programs would be in collaboration with efforts of stakeholder partners throughout the state. It also is our hope that these Maris funds can leverage federal matching dollars, specifically on economic development grants through the U.S. Commerce Department. Thank you.
Who's next? Jim?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Jim Bruno. I'm the founder and CEO of Willamette Valley Vineyards. I want to thank you very much for all the support you have given the Oregon wine industry over these many years. You know what the result has been. The Oregon wine industry is a huge economic engine for Oregon and a remarkable success. I had just two handouts I wanted to show you. The first was this small handout that shows a change in the market conditions that that wineries are facing. Years ago, when you were very active in supporting our industry and helping establish our industry, market conditions were quite a bit different than they are today. Today, there's a much narrower channel for wineries to reach the market and much fewer distributors in which they can engage. As a result, this favors very large wine enterprises, of which Oregon doesn't have any. We're a lot of very small producers. So there is a change in the market condition that really does create a need for us to be innovative in gaining access to these markets. The second thing I wanted to just point out to you is I handed out to you financial information about our Willamette Valley Vineyards, just our company. We represent about 4 to 5% of the total economic activity of Oregon wineries. And the reason why I wanted to show you this was I wanted to show you what revenues we generated from 1995 through, if you flip it over to 2014. And you'll also see the federal taxes we paid, both income, excise tax. And I'd like you to go down to the page, the reverse side, where it shows a total under state taxes. It shows our income tax we paid and our OLCC excise tax. And you'll see that we've paid, during this time period, a little over $2 million in excise tax to the state of Oregon, just Willamette Valley Vineyards, when we write those checks to the OLCC at the end of the year. The reason why I bring this up is that, we're only about 4 to 5% of the overall economic size of our industry. The reason why I bring this up is we pay about 67 cents a gallon here in Oregon, and the legislature allocated 2 cents of that 67 cents years ago to help us with support for marketing. Over that time, just that 2 cents has added up to a lot of marketing and a lot of effective sales. Unfortunately, we're still behind. And in California, my California colleagues are having to write checks at only 20 cents a gallon. I believe it's less than one-third of the rate we pay. So what we're asking you to take some of those funds, invest in growing the Oregon wine industry, which will actually produce more revenue to the state, both in property taxes, income taxes, as well as excise taxes. And the reason why I say that is the proof is already in front of you. It's already occurred. You can see it in these numbers just from Willamette Valley Vineyards.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Dan Jarman representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Just a couple of points to finish it up. You'll have in front of you the Dash 1 amendments. This is one that we want to seek to clarify that no other entities will see a reduction in revenues from wine taxes because of this bill. Had some good conversations with the League of Cities. This also applies to the county. There's wine taxes that goes to local governments to fund things such as mental health, general operations. So we just want to clarify that they're not going to see any less money because of this bill. This is only trying to bring back some of that money that would go directly to the general fund. So we'd be the last thing to get funded with this Maris. Secondly, I think on the – I just noted the legislative fiscal statement. I think it has two pretty large inaccuracies. First, it assumes that this is an ongoing project. It is not. We're talking about just a one-time allocation. And secondly, it assumes that the 1.5 is for each year. It's not. It's for just one biennium. So I'm not sure if that's something that needs to get clarified before it goes to Ways and Means. We'll talk to the Legislative Fiscal Office about that, but that just want you to not have a heart attack when looking at that document before you take action. Then finally, you'll hear some opposition to this bill from the California wine industry. Just a couple of things I'll point out. This is not an unprecedented thing. There's at least four states that use wine tax revenues to promote their local industries. And in fact, if you look at the mission of the OLCC, the mission is to basically support the economic viability for Oregon businesses. So this is something that is already occurring. This taxing regime where the wine board supports, or excuse me, wine taxes support the wine board has been around since 2003. Some of you were here in the legislature when you approved that. This is not anything that's new. So we're not changing that policy whatsoever. We're just trying to redirect some of those wine tax monies to something that's critical for the industry today. So thank you very much, and we look forward to taking any questions.
Mr. Jarman, I asked you up in my room, and I told you I was going to ask you this question, because the real question is interstate commerce laws. Do you feel that this violates any interstate commerce laws?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girod, we as I said, it is a precedent that wine tax monies that come into a state, whether it's an in-state producer or out-of-state, or even international for that matter, they will go into a tax regime in some states, including Oregon, that fund promotion of those local industries. We know of no litigation that has challenged that. I think where you come into interstate commerce clause issues as it relates to taxation is how you would tax a different state. An out-of-state producer different than an in-state producer. We're not doing that at all. There's absolutely no change in tax policy with this legislation.
I'm good.
Senator. Mr. Brunel, you mentioned 67 cents a gallon is what you tax from Oregon. And then you said something about California's tax 20 cents.
20 cents.
So their state taxes them 20 cents a gallon?
Their wineries are paying, their California wineries are paying their state at a rate of 20 cents a gallon, I believe.
California state? Oregon?
California.
Oregon, the California wine folks pay 67 cents a gallon too here.
When they sell in Oregon, yes.
So that's the same.
Yes.
So what is it when you sell your wine to California?
We pay the California rate.
So it's all the same?
No. It's the majority of our sales are in-state. Small wineries, majority of small winery sales are in-state. And so there's a significant economic advantage to be a California winery paying California tax in California, because they have a lot more money left over to beat us over the head when we go out into the marketplace.
Okay. Then one more follow-up. I'm a pear grower, like you guys are wine growers. A little different. We don't get taxed, unless we make pear brandy or pear wine.
That's
very possible. It is possible. But if we want to do marketing, we assess ourselves. And I think, Mr. Jarman, you mentioned you guys have that in your Wine Growers Association. You have that ability to do an assessment from so much a gallon or pound from your grapes too, advertising and that stuff.
Chair Beyer, Senator, in the Oregon system, when the Oregon Wine Advisory Board was established, the Oregon Legislature established a $25 a ton tax on grapes grown in Oregon, which is split between the grower and the wine producer, so $12.50 per ton. And in addition, the Oregon legislature, at the same time they did that, increased the excise tax from 65 cents to 67 cents, allocating 2 cents of the excise tax to the Oregon Wine Advisory Board and now the Oregon Wine Board. And that has been in place since, I believe, 1983.
It's very common, but I didn't know that. I don't think the state of Oregon doesn't tax pear grower, doesn't tell the pear growers what they should assess themselves. We have our own organization. You don't have that same organization?
Yeah, we don't have the same regimen or mechanism.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions? I guess I have one. Do you have any projections in terms of your asking for this to increase marketing, to frankly increase your sales, bring more taxes in? Do you have any sense of what that would do?
Chair Beyer, we do know that we often receive between 7 to 20 times the return on various marketing activities that we engage in. So the dollar return, we believe, will be accretive right out of the gate. And you'll see the return to the state fund through various forms of taxation rather quickly. And the reason why I shared with you our personal financial information is that you could see it in detail yourselves.
I remember from one of the last 2 years when we were talking about this that most of the wineries in Oregon, which are very small, very tiny, that their sales, the majority, I think it was better than 75%, were either on-site or to people who join the wine club, which I think is your primary form for the small guys of marketing. Is you got to get them there than that. And, of course, it's created quite a tourism industry in Oregon. I know I've seen a lot of my friends when I was traveling would rave about Willamette Valley Pinot.
Yes.
And wanted to come and visit, do a summer trip here. So, yeah, I think that works. Although, Jim, I was in a restaurant in Beverly Hills for my wife's birthday a few weeks ago, and I seen one of your bottles of wine on the list for $140 a bottle. I don't think you get anywhere close to that.
Chair Beyer, there's a lot of people between us and that bottle.
Yeah, I know. I've had that discussion with Ed King. Oh, yeah. His $10 at the wholesale turns into 50 or 60 in the restaurant.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Yeah, I've been a big supporter of the Oregon wine industry over the years. And I remember a few years ago, I have a cousin who lives in British Columbia who makes wine up there. And he went on a two-week tour of Oregon with us. And we hit all the little wineries because he was checking it out, because that's kind of what he does. And it was really fun, enjoyable. That, you know, so I'm very sympathetic with what you're trying to accomplish here. The problem is I'm the chair of the Subcommittee on Education, and we don't have enough money for schools. In fact, we're way short by hundreds of millions of dollars. And any way you cut it, this takes $1.5 million out of the general fund. That's the only problem I have with it, frankly.
But you may be increasing the general fund.
We hope so.
But you won't without the marketing. So,
no.
Okay. Senator.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm sort of with Senator Monroe, and in fact, quite a bit with Senator Monroe on this one. We're at a point right now where we're really looking for new revenue, and you know, any money that comes out of the general fund at this point is very detrimental to some other things that we need to do, and it's really difficult for me to put money into the wine board, and we have 30, 40 students in a class. Very difficult. I'm not saying that I'm not going to. I'm saying it's very difficult, and I'm, you know, that's all I wanted to say, I guess.
Chair Beyer, members, what we're proposing is we make more money. And we believe this is a proposal that will do that.
Raise more taxes. Whether you believe it or not, that's the argument.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let's see, and I have Edith Rush. Rush. No. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm choosing the microphone that seems to project in the back. Chair Beyer, members of the Committee on Business and Transportation, I'm Edith Rush, and I am a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon and a retired educator. Just some full disclosure. I'm a very satisfied customer of Oregon's wine industry, as I think many people are. However, what I'm representing today is a little bit of what I'm hearing from several of you, in that this Senate bill supports a public subsidy for a thriving wine industry at a time when Oregon is facing a $1.6 billion deficit. A long time ago, as I was trying to be a good administrator, somebody said to me, Edie, timing is everything. And I would say currently you are all struggling with how to fund basic health care, the needs of our schools and universities, and highway repair and construction. Those are big challenges. And Tax Fairness Oregon believes this bill sets a dangerous precedent at this moment. Imagine every Oregon industry asking you to return millions of dollars in their tax dollars so they can increase their marketing footprint. Not a bad idea, but at the same time, at this moment in time, it really is challenging. I did, as we talk, as people were talking about the market share, one of the things that I began to look at is what is our production share? And I think there are some important quick facts that I found just looking online. Right now, Washington has 10 times our production, and obviously California, with 90% of market share, is well beyond that. So that has something to do with what ends up on shelf space. And I can attest, because I spent 8 years living in New Jersey and another 8 years living in Nevada before I came back to Oregon, the shelf space in Total Wines had a lot of Oregon wines from our small wineries. So they're out there. I was able to enjoy them, but at much higher prices than I typically had paid in Oregon. We want to remind you that every tax refund and grant and appropriation or incentive that you approve in this challenging budget cycle actually is reducing the lifeblood of Oregon. If you choose to support these kinds of measures, what happens is 150 high-poverty preschool-aged children won't get high-quality preschool. That's the number. Basically, 176 teachers wouldn't be hired to work in our overcrowded classrooms. So there are numbers to these kinds of decisions right now. And perhaps our vets won't get an Oregon Opportunity Grant to finish their college education. So those are the hard choices that you're facing, and we recognize that. We also recognize that the request from the Wine Board is not an unusual or out-of-sight request in an economy that is very strong or in a state that has all the fundamentals to deal with it. We do believe that the Wine Board has an alternative. It's currently funded with a tax. If the wine industry needs $3 million in this biennium to cover these costs, ORS 182.470 provides the option to increase the 2 cents a gallon tax. And that would contribute to a really wonderful Oregon Wine is Great promotion. The other thing that I found in the short session last year is we increased funds for the Oregon Tourism Board. And it would seem to me a partnership with the Oregon Tourism Board, there are other funds there that could really support the efforts that they are asking for, because that wine tourism industry is thriving and could be much bigger. I want to be honest, or fair with this. Tax Fairness Oregon is not against proposals that grow Oregon's economy. There are times when I might be leading the parade for this. But we strongly believe that until Oregon has a fundamentally fair and adequate revenue stream that can support the basic needs of our citizens, and a bipartisan legislature should not be considering new ways to spend money via new programs or tax incentives or grants for bright new ideas. So I thank you for your time and your thoughtfulness in considering this.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
And let's see. Katie Chowry?
It's Jacoy. Sorry for the bad handwriting.
Oh, look like, I'm sorry, look like a W, Katie. I apologize.
I'm going to follow her lead and take the right microphone. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Katie Jacoy, and I'm Western Counsel for Wine Institute. We are a public policy association representing 834 California wineries of all sizes. One of our core purposes is to ensure that California wineries are allowed fair, non-discriminatory access to markets in all of the 50 states. And that's why we're here today to oppose Senate Bill 316. It actually worsens an already discriminatory wine tax scheme in Oregon that economically benefits the Oregon wineries, but at the same time is detrimental to the out-of-state wineries. As you've heard already, there is a two-cent privilege tax on all wine, both in-state and out-of-state, and the money is dedicated to the Oregon Wine Board, whose mission, you've also heard, is to support and promote only Oregon wine. In 2005, it raised about $300,000, but only 27% of that was paid on Oregon wines. The rest was paid on out-of-state wines. This tax was added in 1983. There was no sunset on the tax. So for 34 years, the vast majority of the funds that have gone to the Oregon Wine Board by this tax have come paid on out-of-state wines. It actually forces out-of-state wines to pay a tax that directly funds the promotion of our competitors' products. So you've heard there's a 65-cent tax, and there's actually another 10-cent tax if your wine is over 14% alcohol by volume, in addition to the 2 cents that are already dedicated to the OWB. What's surprising is that when you start to look at the system all put together, is that less than 50 Oregon wineries actually pay any Oregon excise tax. And this is because there's a tax exemption, and this is one of the differences, to address Senator Thompson's question, between California and Oregon. California, any winery, both in-state and out-of-state, pays that 20 cents on the very first gallon of wine that is sold. In Oregon, the first 40,000 gallons are exempt from tax, and given the size of the Oregon wineries, typically you have the majority of wineries who are not paying any tax. And actually, one of the gentlemen who testified earlier, at Christom, as far as my records show, they're under the 40,000 gallons, so they would not likely pay any Oregon privilege tax at this point. Also, the small winery exemption discriminates against wineries that produce over 100,000. So it's an exemption on the first 40,000 sales of any winery that produces less than 100,000 gallons. So it discriminates against the bigger wineries. One testified earlier from Oregon, and 298 of them are out of state who produce more than 100,000 gallons. And so they would pay on the first bottle that's sold in Oregon. Under this existing tax scheme, about 70% of the excise tax is actually paid on out-of-state wine. We see this as just one more never-ending payment by out-of-state wineries to subsidize our Oregon competitors. As people have discussed so far, the bill proposes to take money from other programs in a difficult budget time for Oregon. Tough decisions have to be made regarding increasing revenues, taking away tax exemptions, as well as cutting programs. This bill, as it's written, I understand that it's meant to be a one-time thing, but as it's written, it takes $1.5 million every year for Oregon wine promotion. That's actually a doubling of the current statutory amount of funding for the OWB. And we get that taxing out-of-state wines for the purpose of Oregon promotion sounds ideal. The problem is that that's exactly what the Commerce Clause prevents. The Commerce Clause creates a fair national marketplace by invalidating laws that discriminate either on their face or in effect. Without it, California could tax Oregon wine sold in California and give all the money to the Sonoma County vintners for California Pinot Noir production. So in other words, the Commerce Clause prohibits economic protectionism or laws designed to benefit in-state entities at the expense of out-of-state entities. This bill and the entire Oregon wine tax scheme makes out-of-state wineries pay tax that goes directly to the benefit and market expansion of our competitors, Oregon wineries, and therefore we believe that it violates the Commerce Clause. Of course, we understand that you can fund Oregon tax promotion. It just can't be tied to the excise tax that's being paid by out-of-state wineries. These kind of discriminatory structures in all states are harmful. If this policy was picked up by other states across the country, not only California would suffer, but Oregon wines would suffer in those marketplaces as well. So we urge you to oppose Senate Bill 316. We believe the Oregon wineries should pay for their promotion and not take tax revenue out of the out-of-state wine to increase their market share. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Riley?
Thank you. So you'd be okay if we put all this excise tax in the general fund and took money out of the general fund somewhere else and did this, right?
If it's not tied to the money that we're specifically paying, so we're not supporting our competitors directly, yes.
Okay. I'm not sure there's a distinction there, but okay.
It's a distinction without a difference.
It's a constitutional distinction, to be honest with you, in our minds. I mean,
I get it. I understand what you think.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be another way to look at that is all of these monies go into the general fund, and then Oregon is could be making a decision on how they use their general fund.
That's exactly what's happening.
Yes. But when you're tying them to the excise taxes, when you look at the entire scheme, so you can't look at just this bill. You have to look at the fact that we're already paying promotional money in the 2 cents. You already have a tax exemption that keeps the vast majority of your wineries from paying any tax. And then you add taking $1.5 million of the current tax that we're paying the majority of as out-of-state wineries and giving it for direct promotional purposes. I mean, this is to expand the Oregon wineries market at the expense of market share of out-of-state wineries.
Right. I understand what you're saying.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I've taught government history all my life. The Commerce Clause is very complicated. It's been used for a number of reasons. It's been argued in and out. If this was a violation of the Commerce Clause, I'm sure it would have been before some court, and there would have been some ruling on it.
Okay, Senator. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate your time.
That's all I had signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 316. Colleagues, my desire, we'll see if you agree or not, is I think there are some legal issues, but I think they can be dealt with. I don't suspect this is going to move. It's got to go to Ways and Means, and we know that those decisions are not going to be made for a few months yet, so there's time to resolve those issues. What I would suggest we do is that we move the bill to Ways and Means without recommendation. Hey, Mr. Vice Chair, would you like to? Wait, need a dash one? Or would
sure.
You like me to?
I'll do that.
I move we approve the dash one amendment.
Dash one? Senator Thompson has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 316. Is there discussion on that? Senator?
Patrick, could you explain the Dash 1 again, please?
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair, I will be glad to do that. So the Dash 1 amendment clarifies by way of making an adjustment to the statute that the tax revenues from wine tax revenues are to be first distributed to local governments, mental health services, and the commission for administrative purposes
prior to the
$1.5 million
allocation. Thank you. I'm okay with that.
Okay. Any further questions? Is there any objection? There is none. Dash one is adopted. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 316 as amended to the floor without recommendation and refer the bill to Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 316 as amended by the Dash Ones to the floor without recommendation and subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? The motion is adopted. We will close on 316. We'll move on to Senate Bill 330.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 330. Modifies conditions under which an insurer or supervising entity may terminate portable electronics insurance coverage. It specifies that electronic notice or correspondence related to portable electronics coverage may be sent to a vendor policyholder under different circumstances than those under which a notice may be sent to electronically to enrolled customers. We have no amendment before us, Mr. Chair. We do not have fiscal or revenue impact statements on this bill as of yet, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we did open a public hearing. So Mr. Miller and Mr.
Fassfinder.
Apologize for mispronouncing that.
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, representing Assurion. That's my handwriting. I apologize. With me today is Paul Fassbender from Assurion, and wanted to discuss the bill. We're here, obviously, supporting Senate Bill 330. It's an issue of portable electronics insurance. Several sessions ago, we worked with this committee in the House to actually put portable electronics insurance in the insurance code with a lot of the consumer protections that you see within the current statute. Assurion offers the portable electronics insurance coverage through retail outlets such as an AT&T store. And so when you go in, you buy your cell phone, smartphone, and you know the prices of those phones, you're given the option of whether you want to purchase that cell phone insurance, and that's what insurance handles with its partners in the industry. The bill itself deals with consent for electronic notification, which is just a simple fix to the bill that we passed a few sessions ago. And at this time, Mr. Chair, I'll just turn it over to Mr. Fassbender to talk about the need for that consent change in the bill. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for hearing from me today. My name is Paul Fassbender. I'm with a company called Assurion. We're based out of Nashville, Tennessee, and we are the insurance provider for many portable electronics insurance policies that are generally provided through large wireless carriers such as AT&T and Verizon. The fix in the bill that we're talking about today in Senate Bill 330 would allow us to provide easier electronic notification to our customers. A prime example is if there's a change of terms and condition of the policy. The insurance product that we're talking about are fairly inexpensive cell phone insurance products that are a month-to-month product that is tacked onto your telephone bill that is billed through the telephone bill. Currently, say in 35 states, we have the ability to electronically notify the consumer when there's a change of terms and conditions. In Oregon, we do not. We do have the ability, but there has to be simultaneous consent provided. And these transactions, how they take place, they're not in our store. We're not able to be there to get that simultaneous consent. In other states, the transaction takes place by the consumer providing email or providing a email, consent to electronic billing, numerous other consents that provide the circumstances to allow electronic billing under Electronic Notifications Act in other states. This bill would have us comply with certain portions of the Oregon Electronic Transaction Act, which would allow for us to easily electronically notify the consumer about their insurance policy, keeping in mind if the consumer does not want electronic notice, they do not get electronic notice, and they can always opt out as well.
It is interesting. You buy it in the store, and you may not really pay any attention to who the coverage is from. And so if you get an email saying there's a change or something here, they may think it's spam.
Well, now, actually, under Oregon law, we have to provide certain actual hard copy of material at the transaction. Okay. So there is no mistake who this insurance is from. There's no mistake who the insurance provider or the company that is fulfilling the consumer's claim, if they have any. And there's also no mistaking how the consumer walks through these claims, what the consumer rights and the policy terms are. Those are all provided hard copy under certain provisions of the portable electronics insurance laws of the state.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 10, 11, it also changes, provides the vendor, policyholder, enrolled customers with notice of modification or termination, not less. It switched from 60 days to 30 days. So what's the significance of that change?
Chairman Byer, Senator Thompson, that change is simply to attempt to have Oregon more in line with other states as far as notification.
Could you explain that sentence I just read to you? Line 10 and 11?
Yes.
What does that do then? What is that saying?
Senator, it is. You have to give 30 days. Under this bill,
You have to give 30 days or the buyer or
no,
the
No,
the
insurer would have to give 30 days notification to the consumer prior to a change of terms and conditions in the policy.
Instead of 60.
Yeah,
so
currently under Oregon.
Was 60 days in Oregon?
Currently under Oregon law, yes, sir, it's 60 days.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I think the definitions are what's a little confusing. This uses the vendor policyholder. These are all definitions that we had to use to describe, essentially the difference between the insurer, uh-huh, the retail, and then the customer. So
I can clear it up pretty quickly. Let's say wireless carrier A, they are the actual policyholder because these are group policies. Then say I have an Assurian insurance on my cell phone, I would buy into that group policy. I don't want to use the comparison of a healthcare policy, but that's basically what it is. It's a group policy that you buy into, and as the consumer, you can quit it at any point in time.
Well, I don't have anything to compare with. It just goes from 60 to 30 days, so it's 2 months to 1 month. I don't know what significance that has.
What we're attempting to do is make it more in line with the majority of other states. That way we don't have to send out a special notification at a special certain time for this state. That's it.
Okay. Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it from your side.
Yes, sir.
But from the other side, it gives them sit 30 days less notice.
Chairman Byer, Senator Riley, yes, it does. But keep in mind, too, that it's an insurance policy that they can cancel at any time. So they do not have the comparison I would use is my car insurance policy. By law in the state of Tennessee, where I'm from, I have to have car insurance to drive in the road. And that's a yearly policy, and I pay a premium every 6 months, I want to say, and that has to keep up. With a portable electronics insurance policy, such as the ones that we sell, you could go and buy a phone at your wireless carrier, have it for 2 or 3 days, quit it that time, that minute, and we will send you a refund check for the policy. These policies, people have it. I've had mine on my phone for 2 years, anecdotally. Some people only have it for 3 months. Some people have it for 3 weeks. They can quit it at any time, or they can quit the cell phone coverage period, which would also quit their policy. So on the consumer end, it is an at-will policy. We would have to give the notification, yes, for any change in terms of the policy. But also keep in mind there's another on the other end, as you say, the consumer can back out at any time.
Any other questions?
Nope.
Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? Seeing none, we will close on public hearing on this one. We do not have the paperwork, so we'll have to carry this one over. And let's see. We will open public hearing on Senate Bill 331.
Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 331 allows an insurer to offer an insured a replacement policy in lieu of renewing the prior policy if the insurer provides notice to the insured and the insurance producer at least 30 days before the date on which the policy subject to the renewal expires. It permits the insured to cancel the policy within 30 days of receiving the notice, and that the earned premium for the period in which the policy was in effect before cancellation must be calculated on a pro rata basis using the current rate for the previous year's rate, whichever is lower. Specifies that new rates and changes in terms for replacement policy agreed to by the insured become effective the day after the previous policy expires. We have in hand, Mr. Chair, the -1 amendment, which I believe Mr. Cosgrove will explain. It increases from 30 days to 45 days the notice requirement regarding new rates, and makes one additional change. With the -1 amendment, Mr. Chair, this measure has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Mr. Cosgrove and Melissa Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing Nationwide Insurance, and with me is Melissa Crawford from Nationwide. Melissa's an Oregon native who just had to relocate a couple of years ago to Denver, but she's a homegrown person here. Here in support of Senate Bill 331, and she will describe the reason for the bill, but I would like to just mention that the Dash 1 amendment, which staff has mentioned, is one that we would propose if you support the bill, that you would also adopt the Dash 1, and it simply increases the time for the notice to the consumer from 30 to 45 days. And allows this decision that we're proposing to be offered to the consumer to be made before the new policy is effective. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Crawford.
Chairman Byers, member of the committee, Melissa Crawford, Government Relations Director with Nationwide Mutual Insurance. Oregon is one of my states that I handle. And as Paul mentioned, I am an Oregon native. Actually, ironically enough, just south of the Willamette Valley Vineyard is where I grew up. So. Senate Bill 331 would amend Oregon law to permit insurers another option at the end of a policy period. Right now, you can renew a policy or you can non-renew a policy. This would give us an additional option to offer a replacement policy directly to the customer at the end of that policy term. A policyholder can reject that replacement policy just like they could today under current law. Nationwide believes that this is a much more consumer-friendly option because it's less confusing to consumers. When they get a non-renewal notice, it's shocking, it's confusing. Why am I being non-renewed? What does this mean? What do I have to do? Currently, we can offer them a separate letter that explains a renewal policy, but it's still a confusing process. We believe this is simpler and much cleaner. Whenever there's a situation, especially when an insurance company has to move someone from an existing underwriting company to a new product for some reason. And I'll give you an example of why an insurance company might do that. Nationwide operates in Oregon under a large number of underwriting companies. I think we've got 20-some different underwriting companies that have accumulated over time, some through mergers, some through just general business practices. A large number of those underwriting companies don't accept new customers, but they remain open for those consumers who have been in that company for a long period of time. The reason we leave those open is because to move them, we would have to non-renew them. And so we try not to do that because we think it's a consumer, it's not very friendly to our consumers. Nationwide is in the process across the United States of rebranding all of our affiliated companies under the Nationwide name. And as part of that process, we're looking at ways that we can become more efficient, streamline our operations, make it easier for our regulatory partners, make it easier for our consumers, and eventually be simpler for those consumers. One of the things that we're looking at is some of these old companies that no longer accept new members and need to be closed out, frankly. It's very expensive. It's very time-consuming to maintain all of those companies. Every time there's a statutory change that requires updates to the policy or filings with the Division of Financial Regulation, we have to go through every one of those companies, whether or not they're accepting new members or it's just old members. Every one of those companies needs to be operated or needs to be updated. And some of these companies have been around for a long time and are on technology platforms that are very old and don't talk very well to new technology platforms, which of course just increases the expense and the time to do all of that. So we are looking at the possibility of moving some of these, closing out officially and entirely some of these old companies that aren't accepting new members. Senate Bill 331 would allow us to do this in this much more consumer-friendly manner by offering them a renewal option that is with an affiliated company. Senate Bill 331 would require that we give them that new policy or explain the differences clearly in a notice letter. And again, they would be able to accept or reject just like they could today. So the outcome is the same. to the extent Nationwide chooses to close some of these old underwriting companies, the outcome will be the same whether we have SB 331 or not. But we believe this is a much more consumer-friendly option. So we would ask that you support adopting and passing it to the floor.
Questions? No questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's all I had signed up to testify. Is there anybody else? Don't see any. We have the paperwork to move this. Is it? We do.
He said something about the dash one.
Is there a dash one?
Yeah, the dash one, Mr. Chair. There is
a dash one.
Yeah.
All righty. We will close public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 331.
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash one amendment to 331.
Senator Thompson moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 331. Discussion on that motion, and essentially that extends the timeline. Any opposition? That's adopted. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 331 with the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 331 as amended by the dash one to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition on the motion? Don't see any. The motion is passed. Carrier. I'll do it. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 332.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 332 allows insurers to offer certain rebates with an aggregate value that does not exceed $100 in a calendar year to insureds other than persons to whom the insurer issues a health insurance or health benefit plan. This measure also, Mr. Chair, has a dash one amendment. That dash one amendment specifies that prizes, wares, goods, merchandise, articles, or property may be given as form of advertising, promotional program, or promotional material. With the dash one amendment, Mr. Chair, the measure has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Oh, Mr. Cosgrove and Ms. Crawford, one more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Paul Cosgrove representing Nationwide Insurance. And I should have mentioned, with respect to the other bill, this bill as well, although we're bringing this in on behalf of Nationwide Insurance, it's really a matter that could be beneficial to all other insurance companies. Senate Bill 332 addresses an issue that makes it possible, more than in theory, but in practical terms, to offer consumers marketing incentive and promotional incentives, sometimes called rebates, although that implies we're rebating part of the premium. That's not the intent of this bill. It's promotional and marketing incentives. They're currently allowed under Oregon law, under ORS 746-045. The only problem was, as a practical matter, you can't do it because they have to be explained in detail in the policy. And if you think about a marketing program, they change periodically. You don't want to, if they have changed, change your policy for the reasons that you've just heard. It's an expensive process. So Senate Bill 332 has another way, a way that's commonly used in other states, as Ms. Crawford will describe, to allow these kinds of programs to operate without having them being disclosed verbatim in detail in the policy. Again, we have a dash one. Dash one is intended to, we had some concern from some people, some agents in particular, with respect to this. We tried to narrow it so it was clearer that this applies only to marketing and promotional programs. I have used, and I think in one of your offices, I got a smile when I used this kind of promotional program. Is very much like what we used to do with green stamps, and that's where the smile comes. If you're old enough to remember green stamps programs,
might be one of us.
only one, of course. As you know, age. Your view of age varies as you age.
Which one?
What's old?
Yeah, Riley's older than I am.
But these are kinds of programs that are effectively rewards, relatively minor monetary value rewards. And as you'll notice, the program, the bill is limited to no more than a value of $100, which is a common figure. Washington is at $200. We decided to go a little bit lower than that. But they're kinds of things to encourage people to buy products from a particular particular company, and that's what we're dealing with in Senate Bill 332. I'll let Ms. Crawford talk a little bit more about the particular program Nationwide is interested in using and the rationale for the bill. Thank you.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, Melissa Crawford, Nationwide Assurance again. So as Paul mentioned, Oregon law currently has a prohibition against rebates and inducements, but you can have, unless they're spelled out specifically in the policy. Senate Bill 332 would amend Oregon law to allow insurers to offer limited advertising promotional material to policyholders by means of a rebate safe harbor. So if you fell within that $100 per year exception, you could do some of these programs. So it's we feel it's really pretty limited at $100 per year. And it is, as Paul mentioned, with the Dash 1 amendment, tried to narrow it to specifically tailor it to advertising promotional material to address some of the concerns that have been raised. Like the general prohibition, this bill would apply to all lines of insurance other than health insurance, which is currently excluded under the general rebating rules. 27 states plus the District of Columbia currently have rebate safe harbors or otherwise an allowance for rebates. So this is a pretty common thing across the United States. Nationwide believes that the lack of a rebate safe harbor in Oregon and the other states that prohibit it prevents residents from accessing benefits that insurance consumers can obtain in those states that do allow these minimal safe harbors. By way of example, Nationwide has a program. You may be aware of the Plenty program. You might be a member. You might have seen commercials or advertisements on your computer or something. It's one of those little cards you get that go on your keychain, and you can use it at various places. But Plenty is a rewards program that is multi-partner. So Macy's is a partner, ExxonMobil. There's some drugstores that are partners. But Nationwide is also a partner of it. And how it works is that a consumer signs up for the Plenty program. They choose the Plenty partners that they also do business with, so they are in full control of who they want to sign up with. And then that, in Nationwide's case, that member would get Plenty points based on the premiums they pay. They're not allowed to use those points to pay their premium or rebate their premium or anything like that, but they are allowed to accumulate points that they can then use at any of the other partners at Macy's or at the drugstore or the gas station or anywhere else. It's a very small amount, but in a program like Plenty, where they're also adding in their gas station points and anything else, it's a small benefit that makes consumers happy. And we believe that this is a pro-consumer bill that insurers such as Nationwide should be allowed to offer to their consumers, and would ask that you support.
So this is like a frequent flyer card or a Capital One, see the ads for, that kind of thing.
There's various things that could fall under this, but they're advertising and promotional offers that would be given. It's like the coffee mug or the...
Question, Senator?
Are you open to amendments that say that there's a branch of insurance, such as life insurance, if they don't want to be part of this? Is that okay?
Mr. Chair, we're always open to things that make the bill more likely to pass. However, Nationwide is a life insurer as well as a property casualty company. We would prefer to offer our consumers points for the life insurance that they buy from us as well as property casualty. I don't know that there's any policy reason for that exception. I think there's one entity. I saw the sign-up sheet that involves agents that sell a variety of financial products, including life insurance, and they opposed the bill. And obviously, that amendment might turn their opposition to neutrality. So I think at this point, we haven't drafted that kind of an amendment. It's certainly open for discussion.
Senator Riley?
So, one question, and I have two. One question is, do you do any bills that aren't consumer bills? I noticed both of your bills you describe as consumer bills. but that's another topic.
I'll consider that rhetorical then.
And yeah, that was rhetorical. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
This would be, as you say, based on the amount of their policy or however much they spend with you, do you give them a percentage as a rebate or of one of these cards? Or
That particular program is, yes. It's there's a formula that based on the amount of premium they paid, they get X number of points, which go into their pile and accumulates to a dollar amount.
So under this bill, you could also give them a toaster, right?
I suppose theoretically, if you stayed under the $100.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, if I may, other financial institutions have had these kinds of programs and do have these kinds of programs. The one I remember was the Benjamin Franklin back in the old days that actually used to give sets of dinnerware.
Dishes.
Yep. If you that looked like Benjamin Franklin era things, yes. But they would have to be, in our proposal, under a value of $100 per year.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I just switched providers for another kind of service, and they gave me Amazon credits. So I'm not opposed to this at all. If I was in the insurance business, I'd probably switch. But
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Depending on what kind of toaster it was.
Yeah, exactly.
So why was the – I know it's state law, but what was the distinction between PNC and life and health? Why not health?
Mr. Chair, health actually, if you look at the section that we're amending, has its own exemption for programs that are exercise programs and other kinds of programs that you can do this kind of. The insurance section of the Division of Financial Regulation preferred us to stay away from health for that perspective, and we are not a health insurance provider, and so we decided to eliminate, as current law does, health. But we did not eliminate life because it's not treated any differently under the current law.
Yes, and in fact, I believe that the health insurance, they have to be related to health or prevention. I get it with my with mine. I get a membership at a health club.
Yep.
So
that's correct, Senator.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Roger Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing NAFA, which is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, in opposition to Senate Bill 332. I think I can most easily say that our members, who are predominantly life and health agents around the state of Oregon, are just opposed to the concept of rebating in general. When this bill came out, we've talked about lots of different things. I would say the Dash 1 amendment that's been offered makes the bill slightly better in that it prohibits cash prizes, but it still is a rebate, and our members just don't believe that rebating is a practice that Oregon should open up any wider than it currently is. These rebates already can be, as you've heard, can be done through the policy filings. They can offer rebates there. The best one I can think of is one, an auto insurance company that offers like a $25 rebate on their insurance plan if they go 6 months without an accident. But those are done through the filing process of those insurance policies. The other thing about this is that if this bill was tailored only to property and casualty, it would also be less, I guess, harmful, they think. Life insurance is a product that is sold, supposed to be based on the need of the individual, and my members just think it's a bad policy to incentivize people to buy life insurance policies with the promotion of getting something back in return off the premium, rather than tailoring the best policy for the person's need in that product. So With that, Mr. Chair, we are opposed to the bill. We'd love to entertain an additional amendment. I can't guarantee that my clients would say they support the bill if it was limited only to property casualty, but I do know it would get them a lot closer to being not opposed to the bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? No. Guess not, Roger. Thank you.
Thank
Is there
you.
Anybody else? There's a whole bunch of insurance people back there. Anybody else want to come up? No? They're all going to take a pass. All right. Well, I hear the potential for some discussion for an amendment here. Maybe we'll carry this one over.
Yeah.
All right. So we will close the public hearing. And, colleagues, I think we're going to carry over 333 as well. So we'll carry, just noticing, we'll carry over 331, 332, and 333.
You moved 331.
Oh, we did move that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I got carry. That means I was carrying it. Yep. Got confused there. Wrote my own notes. All righty. So with that, is there anything else for the committee?
Oh, we do have some bill introductions.
I forgot that.
So I handed out one of these to each person. On the front side, there's an explanation. On the back side, there's a motion.
I'll just do it. Okay, the chair. Let me see. Chair moves that the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills, and there's a whole list here. LC 1273, dated 11-3-16, LC 1598, dated 2-20-17, LC 1952, dated 2-24-17, LC 2439, dated 11-7-16, these are different days. LC 2443, dated 11-7-16, LC 2571, dated 11-8-16, LC 2588, dated 10-25-16, LC 3193, dated 2-17-17, LC 3245, dated 2-7-17, LC 3246, dated 2-8-17, LC 3261, dated 1-5-17, LC 3450, dated 2-17-17, LC 3563, dated 2-20-17, LC 3577, dated 2-20-17, LC 3579, dated 2-21-14, LC 3709, dated 1-27-17, LC 3710, dated 1-24-17, LC 3892, dated 1-23-17, LC 4057, dated 2-21-17, and the normal comment that is voting to have these introduced does not commit you one way or another to supporting or opposing these bills. It's just getting them on the board. Discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? The bills are introduced. Huh?
That was a mouthful.
All righty. Anything else? We are adjourned. We are adjourned.